The Tom Woods Show, episode 2321.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, believing that the end of the world might be a bad thing that we should try to avoid is not a Russian talking point. But if we are going to avoid World War III, it's important for Americans to understand what's been left out of the CIA's narrative about Russia and Ukraine. Coming to the rescue here is my brand new free ebook, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About Ukraine. Pick it up at wrongaboutukraine.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Kevin Gutzman is with us today. He's a professor of history at Western Connecticut State University. He is the author of James Madison and the Making of America, Thomas Jefferson, Revolutionary, The Jeffersonians. Now, what's the subtitle to The Jeffersonians, Kevin?
Oh boy, that's a good question.
Yeah, you know, is that a good question?
Jeez.
It has to do with Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe. That's what you need to know.
I'll get back in a second.
Kevin's going to look for the book now. I've got my books right on a special shelf, by the way. I'm whispering to the audience while we wait for
Kevin. How about if we start over?
No, this is half the fun.
Oh, that's not fun. Okay, well, the subtitle is The Visionary Presidencies of Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe.
There you go. Now it rings a bell.
That was what I was thinking, and then I thought, no, I don't want to give an incorrect title, so here I am looking like a total ninny, but...
No, look, the host of the program is supposed to be semi-prepared, so it's on me here.
Okay.
Anyway, plus I was talking to the audience while you were back there, so... All right, we're going to talk today, though, at least we're going to use a particular article as a jumping-off point for a larger discussion, but you sent me this article a while back. It's on a site called mindingthecampus.org. I'll have the specific link at tomwoods.com/2321. The article is called Peer-Reviewed History is Dying of Wokeness by David Randall. When you go through this article, you see that what's going on here is he's giving us a review of simply the latest issue of the American Historical Review, which he correctly describes as the flagship journal of the academic discipline. Although, I don't know, I think the Journal of American History maybe has equal claim to that, but it doesn't matter. The American Historical Review is obviously a very prestigious publication. And basically what he does is he just runs through the articles in the current issue because he believes that it's an indicator of where the profession is headed. You read the AHR and you're going to get a sense of where the profession is and where it's going. And it's, do you want to, I mean, I bet people already know where this is going, Kevin. Do you want to spill the beans now as to the kinds of articles one encounters in, I guess, what at that time was the latest issue?
Well, what David does is just go through and describe the various articles, and they're all in esoteric, newly invented subfields of subfields. And of course, he shows that they're all jam-packed with terminology that'll be unfamiliar to anyone who's not among the initiated. And I don't mean even professional historians or even professional American historians. I mean people who are actually writing in these little subfields. Of course, his conclusion is the function of this kind of editorial practice is to demonstrate to the very few people who are the target audience that, yes, I am as devoted to this as you are. And of course, he begins with a piece from Jacqueline Jones, who is a professor at my alma mater, University of Texas, and who's the president of the American Historical Association, and shows that essentially she's very self-satisfied on behalf of the organization that anything you would consider to be among the traditional topics of historical study is really not up to being considered important by them. And rather, we should all think that very obscure events involving people who were not significant on a local level or not achievers of the type we would have thought would be the subjects of historical study or not possessed of the kind of influence that might have made them seem worthy of taking note of, those are the kind of people who should monopolize our attention. It's like an exercise in complete inversion of the purpose of history and the production of historiography, I think.
Well, not to mention, I don't think this is the driving factor, but to be perfectly blunt, you don't have to be that smart. You don't have to be that knowledgeable to do this kind of weirdo niche history. You don't really have to know that much about the broader historiography of American history at large. You just need to know your particular narcissistic obsession. You need to know that. But if I were to ask a lot of these, but not all, I'm sure some of them have their knowledge base. But if I were to ask some of these people, for example, I found the people in my PhD program to be completely unimpressive. If I were to ask them a wide variety of what should be very simple questions, I don't think they would be able to answer. Or if I were to say, well, what would be a dissident perspective on such and such president and why? They would have absolutely no idea about that, of course, because they've never heard any opinion outside their own. But also adding to this, I think a separate issue is that even without the woke stuff, Kevin, I think the subsidies for higher education have yielded a glut of historians to the point where people are desperate to find research topics that haven't been covered already. And the result is ever narrower studies that are of less and less utility for other historians. You think I'm right about at least that?
Boy, I don't know that that's true. I think there are a lot of what one might have thought would be topics that would draw historians' attention that aren't really paid much attention. So in my mind, it's as if what's happened is that people have steered themselves away from intellectual, political, diplomatic, religious, economic history, and they're doing all this other stuff instead.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I was going to ask about that because I would also add to that military history, which is
military, right? Yeah.
Which is considered completely quaint, and that certainly nobody would do that anymore, or that it's not interesting. But yeah, intellectual history has completely suffered. I don't see any of these people even touching on it. And I find it fascinating. And I feel like it's hard to really understand a period of history or a place without knowing its intellectual history. What drives it? What are the ideas driving this place? What makes the people tick? Would seem to be an interesting question. I just happen to remember, again, I'm thinking of my own particular training, but I remember somebody in my department who did a dissertation on like the New York newspaper industry during like a, I don't know, 20-year period or something of the 19th century. And I guess we need that. I mean, I guess you could talk me into that we need that. But I don't know. I just feel like I saw an awful lot of obscure topics. And my question always is, would I ever use this in my research? Or would I ever be inclined to read it? But we can certainly agree that what's being produced today, there's no possible way I would. Because the sorts of articles being described in the piece that you and I read, they're all anachronistic. They're all trying to impose 21st century establishment obsessions onto hapless mid-19th century historical individuals.
Right. It's as if the initial threshold question were, okay, what would people in the past have thought was important? And the answer will tell us what we shouldn't research. So
right.
Instead of considering some Duke in a coastal town in Italy and the way that he ran the legal system there and his diplomatic efforts, a study that one might find here is the experience of some fellow Duke's jailers held in jail for 3 years in the middle of the 19th century. So why would we care about that? That's the point. And again, the bigger questions, the ones that might seem important, are just ignored. I think partly this has to be a response to what graduate students think the market for academic positions is. Maybe they think, if I were to work on that, I'd never be able to get a job, which is possible. But on the other hand, it may be that this is just the kind of people that their current professors think they should admit to graduate study.
Yeah. These graduate programs are going to get even worse than they were in my day.
Right.
I mean, they were positively diverse intellectually in my day compared to what seems to be coming down the pike. I mean, you know, I left academia fairly early on to go do other things, but you've been in it for quite some time. I mean, long enough to be able to have surveyed the profession over the course of decades and observed trends within it. What have you observed? I mean, not even just in the emphases of up-and-coming scholars, but also in terms of the quality of work being put out, the caliber of up-and-coming PhD students, or the factors that drive hiring decisions. Have any of these things evolved?
Well, I don't think any of them has improved.
Well, I knew that.
It does seem, again, that the kind of books that people who are in the prestige positions are producing are just not important. Or in some cases, they may seem important, but their approaches to the material they purport to be describing turn out to be flawed. Some whole subfields of American historiography are organized around guiding books that have basic flaws. So,
can you give me an example of that?
Well, The New History of Capitalism is one that's been in the news indirectly in recent years because some of the works that have been produced by the so-called new historians of capitalism have, among other things, driven the 1619 Project, the New York Times spectacular about the primary role of slavery in the history of the American economy. And it turns out that some of the books that were most relied on in producing that just are based on fundamental accounting errors. So you end up with what's in one case 6% of the American economy being depicted as 50% of the American economy. So the problem, well, what you'd think might happen in that kind of situation is that the book would be withdrawn from the market, or a person who had written it would lose his position or something, but nothing happens. Nothing happens. So I don't think that's that uncommon. I think we have a lot of people who focus on the trivial. And also, of course, we've had famous plagiarism scandals in recent years that have led to absolutely no consequences for the plagiarists.
Yeah.
That's awful. I don't know how else to describe that. So it's not only that people aren't really concerned with giving their fellow citizens accounts of the important aspects of the past. I'm thinking about American historiography, accounts of the past of the United States. But often when they do, they just tendentiously give them incorrect information. And I don't know really how to defend the enterprise generally. Its current state is pretty woeful.
You have some courses up on libertyclassroom.com, of course. And in one of the live Q&A sessions that we did over there, I had somebody ask something like this, that, look, yes, I understand that there are a lot of books out there that are either flawed or biased ideologically or whatever, but how do I know that your books aren't just exactly the same thing, just in another direction? How do I figure out if I'm just a layman, I'm reading the book for the purpose of learning the material, so therefore, because I don't know the material, I'm not in a position to judge one book over the other. I feel sort of adrift. What do you think about that? What would you say to that guy?
Well, in theory, the way this is supposed to work among professional historians is they do the writing, and then their work is evaluated by other people in their fields or subfields in academic journals or in the popular press. And so flaws are exposed, right? But I fear this doesn't really happen that much, because one can pick up a major journal in the field of American historiography and find there's not really much that's critical about the reviews. They're just descriptions, and sometimes they're even incorrect descriptions, or often there'll be lauds given to people who've written mistaken or erroneous accounts. It's very difficult to say exactly how one might approach that problem. I think about that a lot, but can't say that I have a solution. One thing it would require is a shift back, I guess, in the general culture of the profession toward being primarily concerned with correctness instead of advancing what seems to be a multifaceted political agenda.
What do you think it takes to be a good historian?
Oh boy. Well, I think it takes a well-cultivated mind. It takes the ability to express oneself well. It takes curiosity and the ability to formulate interesting, important questions. It takes a baseline of knowledge of the general story of the country or the state or the industry or whatever it is one's writing about. It takes a kind of sympathy for the common man, of course. One expects that people who end up with PhDs are going to have above average IQs. So it takes a capacity for explaining one's findings in a way that's not going to be self-isolating. Other than that, I don't know where to go. I guess honesty, that's one thing too, that seems not to be pervasive at the moment. Is there something I've left out, do you think?
Well, first of all, before I forget, I wanted to say in connection with the previous question, so let me just get this out before I forget it. In my book, Nullification, the second half of that book is all primary sources just reproduced, but highly unusual primary sources. You're not going to remember a statement by Governor Trumbull from Connecticut from 1809. You know, you might be familiar with the U.S. Constitution, but you're not familiar with this primary document,
right,
or this statement by this state legislature or this state Supreme Court. So I put a huge amount of primary sources as a way of showing I didn't make this up. Like, these things are real, and these ideas I'm talking about were entertained and discussed widely in all sections of the country, and here is proof of it. And so in that sense, I wasn't relying on people to trust me or anything like that, or look at my credentials or something. Here are the documents. Now, that doesn't work for every type of book, but it did for this one. So that was kind of how I handled it. Everybody, a quick message from Converso. I use the Converso app for privacy because I care about privacy, and because other messaging apps that tell you they're all about privacy look like the NSA next to Converso. With Converso, you've got end-to-end encryption, no storage of messages on the server, no user or metadata. And it's not just you and me. Huge percentages of Americans are saying they're concerned with their lack of privacy and data security. They're fed up with being tracked online. They distrust big tech. They think they influence politics, you think? And they think their phone's listening in on them. They believe their texts and calls are not secure. Converso solves it all. Full of great features like sensors off, completely deactivates your phone's camera and microphone for ultimate privacy. Self-destructing messages are automatically deleted from the recipient's device after a specified time. You can prevent screenshots from being taken. It's a fantastic app. As I say, I'm already using it, and I'm going to start using it with one of my super elite private groups. So be like Woods and go over to conversoapp.com and grab it. That's conversoapp.com. Now, in terms of being a good historian, well, this also calls to mind the issue of the PhD historian and the amateur historian, like a David McCullough. I don't think he has a terminal degree, and I don't know if he has any degrees in history, but his books sold very well, and I'm sure we can come up with numerous other examples of amateur historians whom the public enjoys reading. And I guess I want to push forward with this to ask you, what do you think a historian like you and me, who went through a PhD program, do we have something that a David McCullough, who's just an educated person with a reasonable amount of knowledge, does not have?
Well, I may be the wrong guy to ask that question in that particular way, because my experience of David McCullough is I read 1776. I found it just gratuitous. He didn't say why it mattered. It just kind of starts at the beginning of 1776 and ends at the end. And there's no background. There's no foreshadowing. There's nothing. He just tells you, as a famous complaint about the study of history used to say, he just tells you one damn thing after another.
Yeah.
And I didn't find that very appealing. I thought that was going to be the beginning of reading his major works, and I just quit after that one. So, but I know a lot of people love it. I know a lot of people love his writing. Especially they liked his Adams book, which is basically about Adams, as I understand it. It's about Adams' personality more than about Adams, say, constitutional thinking or his understanding of his own role in government office, or basically about the kinds of things Goetzmann would write about if he were ready about John Adams.
Yeah.
So,
well, let's take my friend Dave Benner, for example.
Okay.
So he's written a biography of Thomas Paine.
Which I blurbed. I quite liked it.
Yes, I agree with you. And before that, he wrote a book on the relationship between the states and the federal government over the course of American history that's also better than you would learn from anybody in a history department. Almost anybody, unless you're in Kevin Gutzman's class or there are a handful of others, most faculty members would not know that material at this level of detail. And so I'm not one of these academic snobs who feels like, well, you have no right to say anything about X and Y because you don't have a degree in it. I don't believe that. And I think Dave Benner has done better work than a lot of the colleagues I've had.
Oh, I agree with that. Yes, I agree with that. But he gives serious attention and consideration to the major questions that his subject faced, right? So it's an old-fashioned kind of intellectual history book, which I find attractive.
Yeah, me too.
That's actually what's missing from McCullough. He, again, there's not much thinking that goes on. It's just one event after another. So I guess predictably, Dave's book didn't sell as well as McCullough's.
Yeah. Well, it actually, now that you say that, that reminds me of Guido Holzmann's biography of Ludwig von Mises called Mises, The Last Knight of Liberalism, Knight, K-N-I-G-H-T.
Right. Because
that's very much the same kind of thing. It's not just then Mises did this, then Mises did that. Because Guido understands the economics, he understands what Mises was up to, and he understands contemporary thinkers, he can contextualize Mises. But also, as you're reading that book, you're learning economics, and you're learning what different schools of thought believed and what Mises' contribution was, much, much better than you would in if it were done in, let's say, the David McCullough sort of style. And Guido is an economist, just flat-out economist, but he was able to tell that story better than I think most historians could have told it. Let me ask you this, somewhat off the wall, but again, you've been in academia for a long time. Did you teach somewhere before Western Connecticut?
Well, of course, I taught two courses and TA'd for 2 years at UVA when I was in grad school. And then I taught for 2 years at John Jay College in Manhattan. And since I've been at Western Connecticut State, I taught one course at the University of Bridgeport. All of these are in different classes of universities or colleges. One was a major urban public school. One was, you know, an elite public school. One is a regional state university. And I have found that there is significant difference among the student bodies one would expect to find at these kinds of places. Generally, it's not about IQ. It's about the amount of work people expect to do. So at a place like Virginia, when I was a teaching assistant, one of the professors I worked for a year, assigned 300 pages of reading a week. And I led the discussion sections, so I knew the students were doing all the reading. And if you're at a place like the University of Bridgeport, you might hope to assign 300 pages a semester.
Yeah, I know.
So it's totally different.
It reminds me of actually my history training, because 300 pages a week doesn't sound out of the ordinary for a history course. And my problem was one semester, for some reason, I decided to take, I mean, it would be sometimes it'd be 200 to 300 a week in a course. I decided to take four history courses in a semester. And that was just ridiculous, Kevin. That really was ridiculous.
Right.
And all I did was sit and read. That was it.
On the other hand, what were you paying for? That's why you were there.
Yeah, well, I get it. But my gosh, it was. And incidentally, I went into college not wearing eyeglasses.
Right.
I had to get glasses after about a year and a half there.
Same for me.
Was it really? It was from all the... And in fact, the eye doctor said, look, if you ease up on all this reading, your eyesight might actually improve. And I said, well, that ship has sailed. That's not going to be happening.
I told you I'm at Harvard, right? You expect I'm not going to read a lot? That doesn't even make sense.
Well, I mean, I knew it, but I didn't realize just how much it would be. But anyway, but I have a lot of the books that I read in those days because I marked them all up and those markings are still useful to me. But anyway, given all your experience in academia, and I'm not asking you to trash your particular institution, but I guess I want to know, you know, you had kids who went to college. If you were starting all over again and there was a new Gutzman born into the world in 2023, would you be thinking of an alternative path for that child? Or would you say, look, my kids, by the time they go to college, will have their heads screwed on right, and they're not going to come home completely radicalized no matter what happens to them, but they still, as a matter of practical fact, have to go to college. What's your attitude these days?
Well, I've got three kids, and they've gone to three different places, and they've had dramatically different experiences. One of them did have the kind of basically political grading in one instance that you're referring to. And I told her, well, you got to keep your head down. Just, you know better, but you have to say what she wants you to say. So, of course, that's intolerable. That's not what a university's product should be, but kids have to get through their educational programs. If you have a particular career in mind, if, say, you wanted to go into medicine or law, or you have to first get an undergraduate degree and you have to have good grades. So I encounter students who have had this problem often. I hear from them by email, or I encounter them at school, or apparently grading on a partly political basis is not only something that goes on among faculty members, it goes on between faculty members and students. I think it's unethical myself, but it does go on. And again, for some people, there's no alternative to going to college. They have to get undergraduate degrees.
Right, you know? Right. Well, one thing I recommend for people who are in that situation is that the student, once on campus, immediately seek out the student groups where the dissidents are to be found. So that could be a student publication,
right.
It could be a political organization, a social club, whatever, where you're going to be able to talk to other students who have experience at that campus, who will tell you, look, most of the faculty, you know, is going to completely disagree with you, but the truly intolerable ones are the following seven or eight of them. Like, you cannot even consider wasting your time with these people. You want to learn that right away. And that's not hard. I mean, I knew that after the first year. And so I could advise people coming in, you definitely cannot take 20th century American history really with anybody, but certainly not with this woman, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah. And that was helpful. And then also, I've made this point in quite a few times to the point where people are sick of hearing it, but this claim about, let's say I had a libertarian or a conservative publication on a campus, people would say, oh, but you're just preaching to the choir with that publication. Well, be that as it may, I mean, we'll stipulate that that's the case, that it only reaches people who already feel that way. I don't think that's true, but let's say even if it did, there's still value in that. Because if you're a student on a campus where there's immense social pressure for you to believe certain things and say certain things, and nobody's backing you up, and all your new friends think that particular way, if you come across a publication that validates your perspective, that helps you. That helps to buck up your courage. It affirms you in your existing position. And so that's why I often say the choir needs to be preached to. Without that preaching going on, the choir becomes demoralized and might just give in. So you actually are performing a valuable service by putting out heterodox perspectives.
Well, I agree with that. Of course, I don't think there's anything like that going on in connection with the article we began by talking about.
Right.
They are totally uninterested in that. It's rather more of a part of a program to drive people out who don't have the same worldview, I think.
When you were studying at the University of Virginia, I mean, University of Virginia has an excellent reputation. And in terms of history, there have been many distinguished historians teaching there. And the same thing is true even in the Ivy Leagues, that now, these days, it's gotten considerably worse since I was there. But nevertheless, my thinking back in the early 1990s was, this institution I'm attending is full of people I have to be wary of. But it also still maintains a commitment to excellence. And so because of that, and because it wants to maintain its international reputation for scholarship, I could nevertheless be certain that there were plenty of scholars who were genuinely trying to put out good work, and who genuinely appreciated good work. I mean, look, the fact is, let me just be blunt. At Columbia University, my PhD dissertation is very right-wing. Okay, I mean, there's just no getting around. I mean, I try to just be an impartial narrator of events, but it's obvious where my sympathies are. It is the most right-wing dissertation possibly ever presented, at least in the 20th century, at Columbia. And then to get it published by Columbia University Press, it is the most right-wing book they have ever put out. But that goes to show, I was told by the head of the religious studies department at Barnard, which is the women's college at Columbia, that it was an excellent study and he very much wanted to publish it. And so, in other words, I really did encounter people who felt like, this is good work. And I don't like the people Woods is chronicling, but this is good work. And this good work deserves to be recognized. There was still some kind of sense of that. Now, I don't know how much of that is still there. I mean, what was your experience at UVA?
Well, UVA's history department was very congenial to me. I had one professor who was cartoonishly hostile to anybody who was to the right of Julian Bond. But other than him, I thought the whole place was very welcoming. But I had had the experience before I applied to graduate school at UVA of going to law school and getting a degree from the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, which was completely hostile to anybody who was a libertarian or a conservative or basically not an LBJ liberal. And I decided when I was applying to grad school in history, I'm going to avoid that. And the way I would avoid that was say, they ask you this dumb question in your application materials. They say, tell them what you're going to write your dissertation about, which of course you don't know. You haven't been to grad school in history yet.
Right.
But I told them, thinking this will avoid having me have an LBJ school experience, I told them I wanted to write a dissertation about Calhoun, about whom I said positive things in my applications. Not because I knew what I wanted to do, but because I thought, well, if it's like the LBJ school, they won't admit me. So the people at Virginia admitted me, because probably partly because I had a very, very high GRE score and I had a law degree already. But as I said, it was a congenial place. I still am in communication with some of the professors. Actually, one of them now lives in New Haven and I went out to lunch with him a couple of weeks ago. So that was positive. But I've heard from several other prominent schools that the history department's graduate experience is not like that at all.
Yeah. So, and I feel like it's crucially important that we have historians who are willing to work on, let's say, the history of the past 50 years.
Right.
Because that's just not ever going to be told right in any textbook. And certainly the history of the past 20, no way. There's just no chance you're going to get any sensible overview of the Obama years, or certainly not of Trump. Forget it. You will never, ever have any idea of what actually happened and what claims against him were true and which ones were false. You will never get that from any textbook chapter about him that will ever be written between now and the end of the world. So I want to see historians who have the stones to come out and do that. But I think that's going to be happening outside academia. I don't see it happening inside academia.
Well, recognizing that reality about the way that Trump's administration will be depicted makes you wonder how much of what you think you know of any previous one
Yes.
you can trust. Right. Yeah. Because you just know for sure that what you just said is true. There's never going to be anything about Comey and Stroke and Page and all those people. None of
Yes.
it's going to happen.
Yeah.
None of it will be remembered at all.
And, you know, I'm thinking about how are they going to cover COVID? Well, we had this virus and there were a lot of stupid people who wouldn't wash their hands or they wanted to go out and have drinks and they kept spreading the virus. But thankfully, Dr. Fauci came along and got us through. I mean, like, no aspect of that is true.
Right.
And yet it's a virtual certainty that that's what kids are going to get. A virtual certainty.
Yeah, afraid so.
So that's why we do our own thing. That they see, here's the, you were talking about students who actually did the 300-page reading a week.
Right.
Here's where you can be consoled. Most students don't do the reading, you know? So therefore, they might, however, watch a documentary we produce showing all the BS about COVID, but they probably won't read the book chapter. So
it's true.
I mean, I have to take what I get, I guess, in terms of feeling positive about the future.
Well, at the end of Candide, Voltaire has him say, il faut cultiver notre jardin, right?
Yeah.
So that's really all one man can do.
That's what you have to focus on, really, is make sure your own world is in order.
Right.
Because that's really all you have full control over. You and I, Kevin, do not have much influence over the U.S. Senate. Let's just face
it. Who knew?
Yeah, how about that?
Although we know there's one Senate office in which our book is on the wall, so that's nice.
Oh, that's true. That is true. That is true. And, I mean, it's not impossible that Thomas Massie has a book of ours, but we know for a fact, right. So anyway, well, Kevin Gutzman, G-U-T-Z-M-A-N, kevingutzman.com is Kevin's website. You can find all his books there. Kevin and I wrote a book together years and years. It's 15 years ago now, Kevin. What? How is this possible?
Yeah, I'm really old now.
I know. What has happened to us? I look at myself and I say, is this the same person? But anyway, we wrote a book called Who Killed the Constitution? And yes, it is a little old, but you know, it's timeless. That's the word I'm trying to use now, you know, as a substitute for old. Is the book is timeless. So you can check that out. We'll link to that also at tomwoods.com/2321. Well, I appreciate the conversation today, Kevin. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.